Bert Cohen here, keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Who could have imagined a 21st century in which one of the two parties is controlled by a president that over 60,000 mental health professionals have recognized as having, quote, serious mental illness, unquote. Even traditional conservative Republicans are shocked at what has become of their party. Those Americans who lived through the bizarre days of Richard Nixon could never have imagined a president actually attacking and trying to undermine the FBI. And with a formerly grand old party having gone so far beyond normal bounds as to support blatant racists and praise neo-Nazis, white supremacists, one would think that, of course, this moment is one which Democrats would have incredibly easy pickings in upcoming elections. But look at 2016. It should have been unquestionable that the Democratic nominee would beat a man who boasted of his own sexual assault and who disgusted the world with his mocking disabled Americans. But we know what happened. We're still trying to recover from the shock. It seems to me that normally, when a side that is expected to easily win blows it and loses, that side goes into serious and deep reflection. Egos are left at the door because all recognize that winning in the future is just too serious a task. I may have been a minority when I was running for Congress back in 1986, so long ago, when I was saying that if people know what the Republicans are, but don't know what the Democrats are, we lose. Many years ago, a minister friend of mine observed that every election year, people either want change or more of the same. In 2016, Democrats were deeply divided. Bernie Sanders was the candidate of change. Hillary Clinton was the candidate of more of the same. Among the arguments going on now in the Democratic Party circles in the face of the radical and frightening change brought on by Trump, shall we market ourselves as wanting to go back to more of the same relatively centrist, corporate-friendly stance of the Obama years? Or shall we embrace something bolder along the lines of what Bernie Sanders was all about? I'm very pleased to have with us today our guest, Paul Hodes. Congressman Paul Hodes represented New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District, sort of the left part of the state, from 2007 to 2011. He was elected president of the congressional class of 2006 and was the national co-chair of Obama for President in 2008. He serves on the National Council on the Arts and is a lawyer, musician. We'll hear some of that good stuff later at the end of the show. Community leader, chair of the board of the Dance Hall in Kittery, Maine, and an entrepreneur working on an entertainment startup. And Paul, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, Bert.
Always good to have you here. Along with other National Party leaders, Paul wrote a new article in the Huffington Post titled, "Democrats Are Still in Denial." He writes, quote, "Beyond the few bright spots, Democrats are in denial over our persistent structural failings," end of quote. Today, we're going to look at those structural failings and what can be done to correct them. Well, again, Paul, thanks for being with us. As you point out in the article, after any personal loss, there must be 5 stages of grieving. What are those 5 stages and why are they appropriate for Democrats now?
Well, you know, the article that I co-wrote with my good friend Peter Emerson is a pretty lengthy article about the state of the Democratic Party and how we got here, and working through the five stages of grieving, the you know, clearly you start with denial. Once you work through and you accept what has happened and you acknowledge it and deal with it, you can then actually begin to deal with change. But when we looked at the Democratic Party on the national level, and this is not, you know, you and I are sitting here in this gorgeous community studio in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Really, our article was not pitched at New Hampshire Democrats, where we think the organizational abilities and the way we do things in New Hampshire might be a model for the rest of the country. But certainly looking at the national Democrats, we saw a real kind of an inability to deal with some of the structural failings. So we're still in the early stages. I mean, the grieving was profound after 2016, but I'm not sure that for the leaders of the Democratic Party, at least those who are the faces of the Democratic Party now, they've really begun to work through past the grieving to the kinds of structural changes, both in process and substance, that the National Democrats need to go through in order for sustained electoral victories.
We just have to do that. And it's not just about Democrats. It's about democracy itself. I mean, it's really under attack. In talking with Howard Stern earlier this week, actor Dennis Leary, who always voted Democrat, he went home to visit his brother in Worcester before the election and seeing nothing but Trump signs in a community that was solid blue forever. He raised a good and simple point. Make America Great Again was marketing 101, a clear message that resonated with people. Dennis Leary also talked about meeting Hillary and liking her, but added that she was the worst presidential candidate perhaps in history. This is his point of view, not mine or anybody else's. And he pointed out, with many expletives, the ridiculous Hillary for America slogan meant nothing. Dennis also said the Democrats stand for nothing. How accurate do you think Dennis Leary is that people don't know what the heck the Democrats stand for?
Well, I think that the Democratic Party on the national level currently lack the kind of faces of leadership that a party like ours, after the loss we suffered in 2016, needs. We lack a concise policy agenda. But a policy agenda is not the same thing as messaging. And Democrats are perennially sure. Awful at messaging. We always have been. The Republicans, in terms of messaging, have been masters at it. Now, I'll tell you a little story. When I was out there running for office in 06, 08, and the terrible tsunami of 2010, when Democrats got clobbered all over the country. I ran for the U.S. Senate and got solidly thrashed by then New Hampshire Attorney General Kelly Ayotte, who served with mournful steadiness in the U.S. Senate till she was ousted by Maggie Hassan, the governor. Yes. But I would often go out and talk to Democrats, and to a person, Democrats would always say, oh my God, our messaging is terrible, and Democrats have never done anything about it. In the article we wrote, we trace the problems of the Democrats that go pretty far back. I mean, because the Democratic Party as a national party and an institution has been loath to be nimble, flexible, and change. You can go back to some of the issues we faced today to the Clinton administration. I'll give you one example. I served in the House on the Financial Services Committee, and the House Financial Services Committee dealt with banks, insurance companies, and all of that. And you'll remember that between 2006 and 2010, we suffered this massive collapse that was brought about, frankly, by the beginnings of policies from the Clinton era, when the banks were deregulated and compounded by the Republican ideological view during the Bush era that the capital markets would police themselves and we could keep deregulation alive, and nothing would, and they'd take care of themselves. Well, you know, because capitalism cares about profits, not people, any loophole is exploited. My view is that the Bush administration and Greenspan were allowing middle-class people to use their houses as roulette wheels to keep their minds off the fact that they were getting clobbered by tax cuts, which favored the rich and the war in Iraq. Predictably, it all collapsed in 2007. But if you look at what happened afterwards, one of the reasons Democrats suffered so badly was in the wake of that financial collapse. Number one, we rescued the big banks.
Right.
I voted against the big bank rescue, which people thought I was crazy. But I said, if you don't do something, Democrats, to help the homeowners who've lost their homes in a real way, the political consequences are going to be terrible because people are going to only see that you helped the big banks. So we helped the big banks, and they recovered and consolidated and gobbled up a lot of banks and became bigger and are still too big to fail. We got all those problems. But even more important, the then Attorney General, Eric Holder, chosen by Barack Obama, who I love and respect, worked with and supported, did not indict a single bank official or bring to court any of the people who were responsible for the massive fraud. The fact that no one was held accountable for those failures on the Democrats' watch, you see a straight line to the Trump argument against Hillary. You gave speeches to Wall Street. You collected $400,000 from those speeches. You're in the pocket of Wall Street. How Donald Trump, the greediest corporatist in all of captivity, could tag Hillary Clinton with being a Wall Street toady, just from a messaging and standpoint, is beyond me. But it worked.
Yes.
It worked, and it worked for working people of all stripes, not just blue-collar, white working people, but women and African-American working people and other minority working people. And regular folks took a look at Hillary and thought of her as the rich person who was out of touch. And for some reason, Donald Trump, who's a brilliant marketer, was able to market himself into, I'm the guy who understands working people. That is just one example of the failings of a thought process and an understanding on the part of national Democrats to understand who we are, what we stand for, and how to translate that into language that actually reaches the people that we care about.
If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking with former Congressman Paul Hodes about Democrats in denial and what we can do. And I was talking with a mutual friend actually this morning in a coffee shop, Paul O'Connor of the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. And one thing I think we were both in agreement on, you got to go where people are. You know, if you talk at people, let's face it, Hillary somehow came across as elitist. I mean, people who know Donald Trump know. I mean, anybody in New York City would know that he was basically a crook. But going where people are, as you talk about bailing out the big banks, people were affected by that. Average working people, formerly middle-class people, were affected by that. And how could we miss that reality? It just is amazing.
Well, to be fair about what the situation was, clearly something needed to be done to rescue the economy in an emergency. And when I looked at the situation and talked to people, I saw all kinds of ways that could be done either side by side or instead of simply using taxpayer money to fill the banks corporate coffers back up. There could have been a federal home loan bank or some kind of banking, national bank developed to help homeowners there, along with helping out the banks. There could have been a real system of accountability for the banks and how they used the money. Now, in the end, people would say, well, it worked out. The global financial system survived and we've made a recovery. One of the issues for Democrats, and we talk in our article about the real need for a kind of moonshot agenda, because, you know, if I boil it down, I say there are three, let's say there are three main issues for Democrats to come to terms with. There's leadership, there's agenda, and there's messaging. If we just look at those three, one of the components in agenda is really a policy agenda and a prescription that calls to mind the kind of moonshot that John F. Kennedy, an inspirational leader who was able to capture the hearts and minds of a broad swath of America, calling on American forward-thinking ingenuity and entrepreneurial spirit to leapfrog against what was then our adversary in the Soviet Union, the great symbol of which was putting a man on the moon. And in fact, in 8 years, 1961 to 1969, we developed a space program that put a man on the moon. And for Democrats, you know, first of all, we've had a failure of leadership. Now, it's not simply around age. Where's the Democratic bench? Who are the Democratic leaders of the future? And why, for example, is 77-year-old Nancy Pelosi, who I admire and respect, still the face of Democrats in Congress? A San Francisco liberal of a certain age who has persistently refused to hand over leadership when, frankly, she could do all the great things she's doing for Democrats in terms of fundraising and organization, but advance others. For example, Tim Ryan is an Ohio congressman who, it's been reported, and is thinking about running for president in 2020. He stood up to Nancy Pelosi in elections for leader of the Democrats in the House. He lost. But he's the kind of guy who could be the new face of a Democratic Party, a late 40s, former football player, lives in Ohio in the Midwest, a pro-gun control hunter who is a Catholic but is clearly now pro-choice. The kind of face, the kind of guy who can talk to people that Democrats have lost. And that's one example of somebody who I happen to know and served with, who's seriously thinking about how to lead the party forward. But that's an example of a new face. In the Senate, you have Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, who's a prodigious fundraiser, but she's still from New York. There's a senator named Brian Schatz, who's now the senior senator from Hawaii. And when you look at his record and what he stands for in terms of renewable energy and how to renew our commitment to the planet and the world in a responsible way, he's been a leader on that. He's a 40-something new face in the U.S. Senate who also people ought to take a look at. There are remarkable people in both the House and the Senate who we could look to as the new faces of the Democratic Party. And that's not to mention people all over this country, in other state legislators, governors, and offices down below, who once again see that there's an opportunity. Trump and the Trumpeters have opened the door for Democrats. The real question is, can we get it together to walk through that door and then sustain electoral victories? Because if you take a look at what happened in 2006, I was fortunate enough to serve in the majority in the U.S. House for the only period of 4 years in the past 24 years that Democrats have held a majority. And since 2008, Democrats, in terms of congressional seats, Senate seats, state legislative seats, and top offices, have lost more than 1,000 seats nationwide. And that is since Obama was elected president. There are lots of reasons, including racism, for that. But a lot of the reason has been the fundamental kind of drift of the Democratic Party away from understanding its values and its roots in helping, as Carol Shea Porter, my dear friend, would say, the 99% of us on really fighting hard about income inequality, about fighting hard for those who don't have a voice, about being really smart about health care and other important issues, but understanding that we have to create a 21st century economy that leaps over where we are now to really create a new America for the 21st century. That's the moonshot agenda, and that's the leadership. And we can also, we'll talk a little bit also about messaging and how that should be done.
People need to be inspired. People want to be inspired, you know, not just the Democrats that we have lost, but independents and, you know, a lot of people who voted for Trump, they want to be inspired. You know, so many people, it seems to me, feel like this is not our government. The powers that be have convinced most people that we don't have power. But what you're talking about, Paul Hodes, is inspiring. And these are issues that people really care about. And, you know, make America great again. There was some amazing messaging. You know, people use their imagination. You know, it captured the imagination. It seems to me the message of Medicare for all. People get that. It has to be relatively simple and connect with people where they are. Because I think people's, you know, healthcare costs are a problem. They're going to get a heck of a lot worse, I think, under the new tax system. But we need to inspire people somehow. And Tom Perez, the chair of the Democratic Party, is complaining now that, oh, the fundraising is lousy. Well, duh.
Yeah, I mean, look, National Democratic fundraising is lagging way behind. And what you've got is, I mean, Tom Perez came in and has now sacked those who ran against him, including Ray Buckley from New Hampshire, who was thrown off the executive committee. He got back on by a popular vote among Democrats and is still there.
What the heck? A purge? What?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, so the National Democratic Party is an institution in need of total reboot. And you have to go back as Democrats to the fundamentals of what it takes to run a political campaign. The fundamentals of what it takes to run a political campaign are ground troops, where neighbors talk to neighbors. In New Hampshire, that's how we're going to organize.
Absolutely.
We're going to run a neighbor to neighbor campaign, and that's what it takes. You'll recall Howard Dean had a 50 state strategy, which I think had a lot to do with helping. This is in the process and organizational side, and helping Democrats win in 2006. The fact that Howard was doing a 50 state strategy meant that there was sustained support for Democratic state committees in all the states. If you take a look at the squeaker of a win in Alabama, where Doug Jones beat Roy Moore. So, as I said recently on Morning Joe, I was on MSNBC, I said a squeaker of a win against a racist child molester is not a template for victory or a harbinger of success. But the Alabama is such a tough place for Democrats. They basically had to build an organization from scratch. So what the National Democratic Party needs to make sure it's doing is supporting state Democratic parties at the grassroots level in every state and territory in the country, just as a basic for doing the kind of organizing that means that on election day, which is really what counts, folks.
Oh, yeah.
The campaigns run for years and months, and it comes down to one day of getting your people out to vote. It's incredible, and most people don't understand that that's what makes or breaks campaigns. You can organize, you can send messages, but you got to get your people out, and that takes intense grassroots organizing everywhere. And I'm hoping that's what the National Democrats are talking about doing, and that's what they're going to do. I'm not sure I'm seeing it.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I mean, you know, as our friend Ray Buckley knows, you know, it's ground level work. That's what works. Connecting with people. And in Alabama, it was an amazing get out the vote. I mean, you have to.
Mostly by African Americans.
Absolutely. And what, parenthetically, had Roy Moore not been a child molester, this guy who supported slavery would have been elected.
Well, you know, I have to say, in this country, we seem, as an electorate, the majority of people seem to be able to put aside issues that a lot of people who have a conscience think ought to be dispositive. Like, okay, if you're a pedophile, well, that might or might not disqualify you these days.
Apparently.
If you're a serial sexual assault perpetrator like the president, well, we'd think that ought to disqualify people. But, you know, I mean, we're all human, and golly, what's sexual assault? I mean, I'm being facetious about it, but that seemed to have been what was at work in 2016. So if you look at it and say, okay, from a statistics standpoint, Trump won a narrow Electoral College victory because of about 100,000, 70 to 100,000 votes in four states, in kind of Midwest working class states. So there was clearly a failure on the part of the Hillary campaign to go to the right places, to target the right voters. So from a process standpoint, that's an easy lesson, but it never should have been that close. Democrats have lost a substantial part of their base. Part of it is, part of it may be racism, because we had an African American president. But part of it is the failure of Democrats to connect on many, many levels with ordinary people, to convince them, we know what we stand for. We stand for you. We stand with you. We see what you've been through, and we know how to deal with it. And when we get in and govern, we'll deal with it. Now, it's a tough situation. I've always said Republicans run for office saying government doesn't work. They get elected and they prove it.
Right.
And they're doing that now. So the door is open for Democrats. But what's the Democratic agenda? Now, Bert, I know you and I probably agree on a long list of issues that are important. But, you know, Democrats like me like to talk. And the more we talk and the more we explain and the more we appeal to people's thinking, the less people listen.
That's true.
It's like that picture of, I always think of the three monkeys with the, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil. But I think of the monkeys with the fingers in their ears. You can talk till the cows come home, but most people receive messages not from the words, but from something else, something about a person that either connects or doesn't connect. So you could look at this bizarre result in 2016 and say, how could anybody connect to Donald Trump? And you look at Hillary, really smart,
yes,
really experienced.
Tremendously qualified.
And after 30 years of beating up on her by the Republicans in a very effective way, she just couldn't connect with people in their guts, in their hearts, in an emotional way that allowed voters to say, you know, she's for me. Right. I'm with her.
Right.
I like her and I'm going to go with her. Because my experience, and I'd be happy to have anybody disagree with me, I think in the end, when voters get in the voting booth, they're voting on feelings.
Absolutely.
They're voting on emotion. They're voting on, you know, some sense that they've gotten. And all the television ads, the mailing, the social media, the debates, everything else all feed into this sense that a voter has and voters have in the voting booth about the person. And in the final analysis, that means taking an agenda, which I think I have a sort of an agenda that I'm working on for a subsequent article we can talk about.
Oh, yeah.
But it means translating it into emotionally resonant messaging. And there's a way to do that. The Democrats, and I know this from firsthand knowledge about how Democrats develop their message, Democrats are loath to use. I'll give you an example. So the Democrats, and we talk about this in the article, Democrats have adopted a slogan. And it's a slogan which doesn't resonate, which nobody will use, and nobody gives a darn about.
Right.
And that slogan is a better deal.
Right.
Now, I say a better deal is like, okay, you open an obsolete mail order catalog from an obsolete mail order company, and you're looking at dishwashers, and you've got good, better, best, and the good one is really cheap and doesn't have any features. The better one is a little better. It's got a few more features, but it'll break in 5 years. I better spring for the best, which is more expensive, but I know will last. And we've chosen that middling dishwasher from an obsolete mail order catalog that's going to break down in a short order, so I better spend more money. When when what we're really talking about is how do you develop a message that reaches the hearts of people? Republicans are really good at it. And here's an example. You tell me, do we have time to...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so here's the example. Our listeners will be familiar with the term death taxes.
Yes.
Everybody's familiar with the term death taxes, but where did that come from? How did that spring up so that every Republican in the United States, from the lowliest county commissioner or registrar of deeds to the leaders in Congress and Senate, start talking about death taxes so that the term became ubiquitous and the pejorative name for taxes which are mostly paid by the wealthiest only in this country. Mm-hmm. A very, very small percentage of people in this country, I mean a tiny,
yes,
tiny, tiny number of people have to pay a tax on the inheritance. It means about $300 billion under the new tax bill. They've wiped that out by doubling the exemption, so that's a gift to rich people. But putting that aside, where did the term death taxes come from? Nobody knows. It didn't just come out of nowhere. Now, when the Democrats developed their recent slogan, A Better Deal, what did they do? They went and they talked to elected representatives, members of Congress and the Senate. They talked to Democratic staffers and they talked to Democratic consultants, all of whom
Democratic
have a vested interests and no idea of what's really going on at the grassroots. How did the Republicans develop death taxes? Well, I'll tell you. They used a Madison Avenue technique. And in fact, what was then a Madison Avenue firm, the people who understand how to sell soap, how to make something new and improved, how to get the word out when they want to change the way people think about products, the great PR marketing machine of American capitalism. And there is a firm, which is a chip off the block of the Omnicom advertising empire, and they are wordsmiths, and their business is developing language that reaches people emotionally, and this is how death taxes was discovered. I'll tell you how. So the first step, step one, that the firm employed, and I know who they are and where they are, the first step they employed was conducting extensive interviews with regular people. Imagine that.
They listening to people.
They
what
went out and listened to all kinds of
wow,
people
radical.
All over the country, not Democratic operatives,
right.
not Republican operatives at the time,
sure.
But to talk about this issue about taxes and the government and what do you think. And in those interviews, somebody, a guy, drop the word, I can't take it. It's like I'm being taxed when I die. It's a death tax. And being attuned to language, the folks, the interviewers, picked up on death taxes. But they didn't stop there. They then relentlessly tested it, which was with what was then a new testing mechanism. The mechanism was called focus group dial testing. Now, by the way, if we look at debates on television, you will see in almost all the networks focus groups who are being interviewed by somebody
right.
after the debate.
Right.
And during the debates, you will see that this selected focus group, which has been demographically suggested, is using a dial to register their emotional response to
and
what is being said.
You can see it at the bottom of the screen.
You see it at the bottom of the screen. Donald Trump says, make America great again, and the mm-hmm. and the lines go up. Hillary Clinton says, go to my website and read my plan, and the line plunges to below where the graph can see. Because, by the way, who has the broadband and the computer to even look at her plans, and who's going to go to a website to read a plan?
Oh my God.
What a thing to say. So anyway, you have focus group dial testing, which is designed to get past the rational thinking,
yes,
into your emotional response.
Absolutely.
And these days we can go even further, because now with new neuroscientific techniques, we can actually find out how words, what words light up in what parts of the brain. So if you're spending the money on a firm that knows how to do this, you can actually go to a university or some other place and say, okay, here are the language I'm testing.
Right.
Does it light up like chocolate, or does it light up like horse manure? And and you can actually get some good information about the language. So that's what they did essentially with death taxes. They went and they tested it relentlessly with focus groups, and it looked pretty good, but then they didn't stop there. Then, and only then, they used polls, very sophisticated polling, to see how that language resonated. And once they had all that together, they rolled it out in a coordinated, cohesive way up and down the entire infrastructure of the Republican Party. Basically, thou shalt all use the term death tax whenever you're talking about this. And today, that's the language. It has become the language. Republicans have been good at negative, fear-based messaging.
Absolutely.
Forever.
Fear. And FDR warned us about fear, and it's true, because it has been manipulated, and it can be manipulated. And, you know, you think about the term death taxes. People don't like death. They don't like taxes. Pretty simple.
It's pretty simple, and it's very emotional.
It is emotional. And you've probably heard this story about Adlai Stevenson. I'm not sure if it was 52 or 56 when he was running for president. And a woman came up to him all excited, said, "Oh, Governor Stevenson, all thinking Americans will vote for you." And his response was, "Well, thanks, ma'am, but I need a majority."
Right.
Because it's emotion. You're right. And I wonder about, how do we connect with people? There's so many Democratic pollsters and people who are on the gravy train, let's face it, who are loath to go to any boldness. They don't want boldness. They figure, oh, it's going to scare people. It's going to frighten people. Let's just go to the middle, the safe middle, and, you know, some kind of centrist thing. And as Jim Hightower of Texas, I'm sure you know this slide, said, in Texas, there's only two things in the middle of the road, yellow stripes and dead armadillos.
Yeah, right.
And I, you know, it amazes me how the Republican National Committee at this, you know, local and state level, people get it. I think the Democratic Party is very different and really gets where people
so,
are.
So, you know, look, let's, if you take a look at the Republicans these days, it's a pretty scary, scary place to be. Trump's approval is at 34%. Democrats have won some recent victories in Virginia,
yes,
in New Jersey,
yes,
in Alabama, none of which, by the way, are necessary harbingers of future success. But it's clear from the way that trends are going that theoretically the wind is at Democrats' back in 2018. Theoretically.
Right.
Right now, we're great at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Very
and
much.
And a lot of the races that are going to be run with no presidential candidate leading the way for us, it's a tougher road, because usually Democrats have relied on their president, and both parties rely on their presidential candidates to be the message carriers and lead the way. In 2018, we don't have that. And we've got a very tough uphill road for Democrats to take back the U.S. House, to take back the United States Senate. These are very, very challenging races, which are going to be a combination of both national politics and local politics. To the degree that Democrats run effective negative campaigns and tie whoever local is to Trump, for example, in New Hampshire, it's not the Sununu governorship, it's the Trump-Sununu administration here in New Hampshire. It's simply Trump-Sununu.
Sure.
Sununu will say, well, I departed from Trump, and Democrats, of course, shouldn't care about what he says about that, and never say his name without saying Trump-Sununu.
It's true.
That's the negative proponent. But what about, what do Democrats stand for, and
yes,
how do we convey
people
that?
People are hungry for that. They're
so
hungry for that.
So let me tell you, I'm writing kind of a prescription article now,
right,
to follow up on our first article about some of the issues. And I'm going to propose, in general, a four-part concise agenda. It's education, innovation, infrastructure, and reform. And I
got to interrupt just for a second. I thought it was fascinating. There was a social media guy who worked on Trump's campaign, and he just was really into the weeds here and figuring out what connects with people. I mean, just amazingly scientific. He said the most effective message was concern about infrastructure. I have never understood why Democrats don't talk about infrastructure and a massive new program to create good jobs. It connects with people.
Sure.
But sorry, that's just an issue that I care about. So
no, well, I mean, it's true. It's about, there's jobs. Now, look, the unemployment in the country, in New Hampshire, has come back.
Yeah.
In a very different way. The notion of recovery implies a recovering of what was. And in fact, the recovery that we have gone through since the Great Recession is a recovery that in many ways has cemented what was. What the result of this recovery has been is increased income inequality, corporate America sitting on huge amounts of profits, we now have complete disarray coming in healthcare and social programs. The Republicans, by the way, are going to try to use the deficits they've developed in the new tax reform to go after Social Security and Medicare. Oh, so what should the Democrats' response be? In my judgment, it's leapfrogging over where the economy is now to develop a very practical agenda that says, how do we get from here to the future where we rebuild a middle class and for working people that has been decimated in terms of real wages? People are working two and three jobs to make what they did. They're going to find that the social services that Democrats care about are under attack. So in terms of a basic sustained agenda, if you think about it, education means developing a skilled, creative, 21st century workforce. Yes. It means providing the means for those who don't have skills to get the skills they need to get into the workforce. What are you going to say to a former factory worker who was making American goods in Ohio, who's now out of a job because all the factories have moved due to globalization? There's got to be a way, without damaging the person's pride, to provide work. It may mean retraining. It also could mean a WPA-type program. But education is the key to building a 21st century workforce for an entirely new world, because the jobs that are coming and the old jobs are being threatened by artificial intelligence, globalization, robotics, and
you can't stop it.
And the age of acceleration, as Tom Friedman calls it, which is completely changing what industries will be, should be, and where we find the markets. So our educational system, our educational system was designed at the turn of the 20th century by the great industrialists, Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie, to produce factory workers who would work in their factories and do rote tasks until the cows came home. Yeah. We now need a creative, nimble workforce. The educational system is a key. Innovation, well, we're going to have to invent the new industries to employ people. And that means throwing huge amounts of investment, both public and private investment, into R&D and sustaining the innovative and entrepreneurial spirit of this country, and calling on our moonshot ability, yes, once again in terms of innovation.
Right.
Infrastructure, because not only is it the place for jobs, but our infrastructure is crumbling. Our physical infrastructure is crumbling around the country. You look around the world, developing countries are spending huge amounts of money to develop real infrastructure. We need our physical infrastructure, but more than that, we need to develop world-leading broadband, digital, and energy infrastructure that will create the foundation for new ways of generating and distributing our energy in a sustainable way. So that's new infrastructure. And finally, reform. Here's where it gets sticky for Democrats, because not only do we need campaign finance reform, that's a very important issue, but we, given the demographics that we're facing in terms of federal budget debts and deficits, we're going to have to find a way consistent with Democratic values to deal with the deficiencies in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that will make those programs sustainable in the long term so that we don't lose the programs, but we make them sustainable. Because right now, those major programs, even and especially with what the Republicans have done, are on an unsustainable track. So that in order to have the kind of progressive programs that we want for people as Democrats, we're going to need to be relentlessly fiscally responsible about our national debts and deficits, because right now the national debt is taking 20% plus of the federal budget to pay for it every year. Interest on loans, much of which is being driven, most people don't know this, by the major programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So we're going to need to do some reform that's going to be tough for Democrats to follow. And the last thing I'd say is, and this is sort of a counterintuitive for Democrats, it's easy to bash corporate America. It's easy to bash capitalism. A lot of people say, well, it's just greedy capitalists, it's just greedy businesses. Take a look at all the money that corporate America is sitting on and the income inequality. Well, you have to, I think, sort of parse those issues, because I think that what Democrats need to do is understand business, is to accept the financial system we're in and find a way to bring the social compact of businesses back to the values that are so important to Democrats of community, family, giving back, and a virtuous cycle. If you think about corporate America in the days that you and I, who are of a certain age, Indeed. Grew up in, we were making things for the world. After World War II, the American industrial base provided jobs for huge numbers of people. Energy was cheap. We made the stuff yes. that was sold to the world.
Absolutely.
Now we import all the stuff that's made around the world. And the virtuous cycle of companies, American companies, with a family approach to hiring people, lifetime employment, giving back to their communities, has been replaced. Well, if that's the reality, Democrats, and I don't necessarily have all the answers for this, but I know how to ask the question, how do we reach out and bring the business community in to Democratic values to help them understand that if we're simply a country of very rich and everybody else,
right.
We can't survive with the fundamental democratic principles and institutions we have. We need opportunity for all, not just for a few at the top. And it's in the interests of business to make it so, just as it is in the interests of everybody. And that is a bit of counterintuitive thinking for Democrats.
Well, it was sort of where Paul Tsongas was in the early 90s. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here, Keeping Democracy Alive, along with former Congressman Paul Hodes. We're talking about an article he and some colleagues wrote for Huffington Post, and what a prescription may be to stop the denial and to connect with people. And I think some of the things that you were just talking about, those points there, they can be marketed. You know, people can understand. People get we need education. People get that we need innovation, like the moonshot. You got to connect with people, fire people up. I worry a little bit. Well, I worry a lot. You know what me worry? Hell yeah. A big portion of Bernie Sanders' strength, of course, was the millennials, and it still is. As your article mentions, quote, recently a longtime respected political analyst was overheard cleverly intoning that the average age of the Democratic leadership is dead. Now, that's pretty funny, but it is worrisome. I see a lot of millennials dem-exiting, you know, exiting from the Democratic Party, giving up on our party. I think this may sound critical. I suppose it is. You know, expecting instantaneous results, it doesn't work in politics. That's not how history has changed. There's millions of millennials. And I think Bernie connected with them with regard to education, funding for education. Of course, the Republicans said, you know, they connected with people saying, oh, free ponies, right? You know, so I guess two questions. Connecting with millennials, huge. And how are we going to pay for it?
Yeah.
And connect with people. We can say, well, raise taxes on the rich, but I think that scares people, quite frankly.
Yeah. I think we are, I'm in the middle of reading Tom Friedman's really important book, Thank You for Being Late. And as Friedman points out, Tom Friedman is a frequent writer for the New York Times.
Yes.
A guy whose values seem to be progressive, values are progressive, and who's really adept at capturing what's going on in terms of major trends. As he points out, consider this. It was only in 2007, folks, 10 years ago, that we got iPhones and smartphones. And in those 10 years, think of how society has changed. The age of Twitter that Trump was able to use so effectively is brand new. Many of the search engines we use, brand new. The way in which miniaturization and acceleration of information have happened really are in the past decade. Our institutions, our thinking, and in fact, humans as beings are really incapable of catching up and making the kind of transformation we need to catch up to the technology we've invented. We've invented these tools. And Friedman now says, look, we're in the age of acceleration. Everything is moving exponentially faster. So you have an entire generation and generations behind them, in the millennials, in the X generation, in the Y and Zs, all of whom have grown up with access to information and addiction to screens of both mostly small varieties. That means a fundamental change in the way we communicate and the way we speak and think about what is possible. I'm not sure that as much as we've tried as Democrats, we've really caught on to the sense of acceleration and the disconnect of government institutions, which are designed and were designed to be reflective, responsive, slow-moving bodies as a stop against rash thinking. So you have the government of the United States. When I got there, everybody was on Blackberries. They wouldn't let iPads onto the floor of the House of Representatives, some of which has changed. But our institutions were designed, the democratic institutions of government were designed to work slow in an age of acceleration. Somehow, we have to learn to bridge that gap.
Wow.
It's not just social media, but it's understanding that, frankly, and as baby boomers, we're in denial of the fact that under our watch, things have gone to you know where in a handbasket under our watch. The effects of climate change, the chaos in the world, the rise of radical religious extremism and the violence that that has engendered, the threat of nuclear war, which we had beaten back,
we thought,
has now come back in a big way. So the millennials are saying, maybe, folks, it's time for you to overtly move aside, to say it's time for millennials who have a very different consciousness, in which what I've observed is that a younger generation, they're not concerned with the color of somebody's skin, and that has pushed society. They see what's happened with climate change. It's not even an argument.
Right.
They understand the age of acceleration in a way that we don't. So one way would be the leadership question. It's time to elevate younger people who are connected, who are closer to younger generations, into visible places of leadership and real leadership in the Democratic Party, who say, this is not your grandfather's Buick.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking forward, and we are going to look forward, and we need you to become involved. More than ever, we need a completely engaged citizenry who understand that every voice really is important. And thankfully, we are beginning to see young people and women and people of diverse ethnic, racial, gender, sexual preference backgrounds beginning to get the message that this is our country, this is our government, and it's up to us to take it back. As whatever you call the establishment of Democrats, whether it's 77-year-old Bernie, 77-year-old Nancy Pelosi, it's time to reach out to young people in that way and think about how we make the transition to power.
And it reminds me of what happened in Alabama. You know, it's not just saying, well, we need you to the African Americans. We are here for you. We are listening to you. You take it. So many people feel like, oh, I can't do anything. I'm powerless. There's nothing I can do. That's exactly what the bad guys want us to believe. We are not powerless. And I think when young people see through demonstrations, through a few things, that speaking out, getting involved does matter. We can make a better future. I just want to ask one last thing before we get to your music, which I'm looking forward to. I've long argued that political purity is poison. For example, reproductive rights. You and I we're strongly pro-choice. Working class Catholics used to be a big part of our base. Your article asks, will the purity of political ideology trump the practicality of what it takes to win?
Look, there are values that we care deeply about.
Yes.
And there are values the Democratic Party stands for in terms of plurality, equality, opportunity, justice. These are all, they're vital. And there are large swaths of this country where issues around choice and abortion are the only issue that count to people. If I look back in terms of my time in politics, I note with some interest that in 2006, Rahm Emanuel, for all of Rahm's faults, helped create a new Democratic majority in the U.S. House that was very important. We had a hand in putting the brakes on the war in Iraq. We had a hand in electing Barack Obama. We also elected Blue Dog Democrats, many of whom were in red states who've now gone to the dark side completely.
Yeah.
But who were not pro-choice. They were either agnostic or their districts basically required them not to take positions that were not consistent with orthodoxy in the Democratic Party. But we won. And we won in districts that have now gone completely to the dark side. So if it's a political purity litmus test that any Democratic candidate, no matter whether they're in the deep red South or deep red West or anywhere else, has to be aggressively pro-choice.
That's a mistake.
Then will we win? So that's my question. The party could choose political purity. I think we need a broader tent that has strong progressive values, but understands that now, folks, we have an opportunity to attract lapsed Republicans of conscience and independents who can't stomach what's happened to the Republican Party, but are very wary of where Democrats are. In order to do that, we're going to have to walk a fine line, but marry our progressive values with a broader tent that says, bring me your tired, huddled masses. We'll take a broader spectrum because we want candidates who fit their district, their region, their state, their town. And we're going to be a grassroots party that takes a look not just at the top offices, but we're going to have to go all the way down from the very bottom to the top and find people who are with us on most issues.
Right.
I know this is a challenge. I know it doesn't make me feel the best I can feel about it because I'm relentlessly pro-choice. I think it's fundamental. I think it's important. But if your religious principles are such that you can't get there, but you're with Democrats on income inequality and racial justice and the environment and education and innovation and infrastructure and reform, we're going to have to open the flaps of the tent to rebuild some of our coalition.
All right, Paul Hodes, I got to hear some of your music now. I mean, you're a politician, but you're also a fun musician.
Yeah,
I'm
a musician. Here's an old song. My wife, Pego, and I have gone out as Pego and Paul, and this is a record that we made, I think, back in the 90s called Patchwork Quilt. And this is a tune we wrote called Stand Up, Speak Out. Here we go.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks so much for being with us.
run away from trouble.